Okay, so for this lecture, we are starting with the caudates, the salamanders. What is caudata? What does that mean? Tail, right? The tail. And so these are tailed amphibians. Of course, some of the gymnophiona also have tails, certainly not as developed and as long as the salamanders. And it's pretty much believed that all Paleozoic amphibians had long, long tails, okay? Which we'll talk about a little bit later. They have very well-developed limbs, except for those that are aquatic, and we'll talk about which ones are those. The ones that are aquatic, as you would expect, have less of a need to run around, so their tails are generally more developed. And they use that for swimming, although some are more degenerate with respect to their limbs than others. Most salamanders have an internal fertilization, as Dr. Echternaut was talking about, where there's a spermatophore that is deposited by the male. Often after some type of courtship, and then the female picks up the spermatophore and becomes, and then fertilizes the eggs subsequently. And then often then lays those eggs. Most salamanders do have external larval development. They're not viviparous, most of them, okay? And, well, y'all know that they sort of look like lizards. Okay, let's see what else. This is another thing that we touched on last time, is that they lack tympanum in the middle ear, and so the operculum, or the opercular channel, is the way through which they sense sound. Okay? And there are some salamanders that do not even have operculum, and they're technically completely deaf. We'll talk about those later. Unlike the Caecilians, the caudates have mostly a temperate distribution. Caecilians are entirely tropical. You can see that there are some salamanders that go down into South America, and that is actually restricted to one family, the Plethodontids, which we'll talk about in just a little bit. Okay. One of the epicenters of diversity and considered an epicenter of evolution is the Appalachian chain, and the Smokies are known for their relatively high diversity just within the park, or high richness. Just within the park, there are 31 documented species, and within Tennessee, there are around 65 species. Accounting for about two-thirds to 70% of the species within Tennessee. So when we go on our trip, last time we were up there, we encountered around a dozen species, which is of salamanders, which is really unheard of. You know, I'll have to find out. Probably in the country of Costa Rica, there are probably about a dozen salamander species, although they have like 1,000 unearned species. So it's pretty interesting. We have we are definitely located in an area of high salamander species richness. Okay, there are 10 families of salamanders, which we'll go through, and we'll talk about some of the key characteristics of these families, so you're aware. All right, first, again, just like last time, we will start with the family that has the most species, which are the Plethodontids. These are the lungless salamanders, okay? So as you might expect, they don't have lungs. Okay, there are 370 species of Plethodontids. Around 70% of the total number of species within the order. They have a U.S. and neotropical distribution, And of course, because they do not have lungs, they exclusively rely on cutaneous respiration. All right. Now, I don't have this on here, but I want us to cogitate and to think about why might these organisms lose lungs. It is thought, and it's believed, and there's evidence that gilled fish ended up acquiring the ability to breathe with lungs by altering their swim bladder, became had lungs, and then this particular family ended up losing lungs. Now, why would you lose your lungs? And I will tell you that this particular family is found in most often in mountainous areas in very cool water streams. Now, with all your knowledge, and perhaps you already know this, what might be some of y'all's hypotheses of why you would lose your lungs if you're a salamander? Considering that background introduction. Mountainous streams, going through the Smokies, for example. That is exactly correct. Colder water is higher in oxygen, plus flowing water is higher in oxygen. So it's thought that basically, because this group primarily inhabits areas with cool water and flowing, highly oxygenated water, then the need for being able to have lungs to acquire oxygen is less. Moreover, if you have lungs that and you're in a stream, that can work against you negatively because it can make you very buoyant. And so it can cause you to potentially float downstream and get into an area where you don't want to be. Okay, so that is another thought. Now, there are other thoughts as well, which probably may work in combination or just be suggestions that have no truth, who knows. That is that these salamanders primarily go through a terrestrial courtship, not an aquatic courtship. And it has been shown that basically terrestrial courtships require less energy than aquatic courtships. Consequently, less energy, less oxygen is needed to perform those courtships on land, and thus maybe the need for oxygen is less. It's a hypothesis. The other is that one thing that you will notice with the plethodontids is that they have a very small head compared to a lot of other salamanders. Very narrow head, and it's believed that body form evolved because they are often associated with mountain streams and hence more of a fusiform type shape with less resistance, again less of a chance of being washed downstream. And because of that narrowing of the head, that potentially that reduced the amount of oxygen being inhaled and is another mechanism or co-mechanism. Anyways, those are the thoughts that are out there, those four thoughts. But probably the first two are the primary reasons. Highly oxygenated and less buoyant. And we see that with another group of salamanders called the torrent salamanders, which we'll get to towards the end, which are found in the northwestern United States. And they're in a different family. Okay, but these are the only lungless salamanders. The other ones we'll talk about in a little bit. The torrents, they do have lungs. Okay, we talked about the reduced skull. The other thing is they have this nasolabial groove that's thought for chemo reception, which is unique to this family. Okay, so they have a groove right in the front on the, of their lips. Okay. The second family, the true salamanders, Salamandridae, 13% of the species in the order reside in this family. These are found in the United States, Europe, and Southeast Asia. They do have lungs, and every family past here, again, as I mentioned, only the Plethodontids don't have lungs, so every family after here has lungs. Whenever you see something brightly colored in nature, and especially with amphibians, it usually means they have very toxic skin. What is that coloring called in ecology? Y'all remember this? General Ecology 101. Warning coloration. Yeah, warning coloration, aposematic coloration. So we'll talk about that later, actually. But so it's saying, hey, has a very recognized pattern for predators. And these do have free, most of the species within this family have free swimming larvae.
Why did you say generally why their lungs reduce? Did you say that last time? I'm not just
taking
stuff up on
my head. Oh. Last time I believe I mentioned something about for some of the families they may have a of amphibians they may have a reduced lung.
Maybe you said it.
Yeah, I do remember, and that is I will have to look that up, but that is in. Well, it's either in the Sicilians or one of these families of salamanders where one of the lungs is reduced. In fact, it may be the torrent salamanders. Yeah, but it's not this family. Okay? Yeah. No, good question. Okay. Good? Questions? All right. The Asian salamanders. This family, 51 species, 9% of the species in the order. And as their name, their common name suggests, they're all found in Asia. An interesting reproductive characteristic of this family is that basically there isn't a whole lot of courtship, which is not traditional for salamanders. Most salamanders have some type of elaborate courtship, and we'll talk about that in the next lecture on breeding, courtship and mating, or breeding and mating, or whatever it's titled. But in this case, basically it's more like a fish. The female comes up, lays her eggs, or deposits her eggs, releases her eggs, and the male deposits sperm over them. Okay? And these have, all of these have free swimming larvae. Oh, one other characteristic is that their teeth are interrupted and in patches, okay, instead of completely continuous. All right, the fourth family, the ambiscomids. The mole salamanders, these are found in North America. Okay, there are 32 species. They basically are within the United States and Canada, and a couple species go down just into northern Mexico. The ambiscomids are highly terrestrial, meaning they will get away from water, but well, at least most of them. And most, if not all, have free swimming larvae. So they get away from water, but they come back to an ephemeral pond or a permanent water source, and they for breeding. All right. As their name implies, they are also very fossorial, in that they are primarily above ground for only a short period of time when they're breeding, which is primarily during the winter, during January and February, okay, and March throughout their range. And they come out for short periods of time, they go down to the water source, and they breed. Okay, so they're primarily winter breeders. They do have an elaborate aquatic courtship, which, again, we'll talk about aquatic courtships in the next lecture. Let's see, what else? And they have free swimming larvae. So these guys, again, they're underground. They can dig some with their front legs, but they often follow cracks down or go into animal burrows. These are found in very dry regions. This species right here, Ambisma tigrinum, and the subspecies of this is Mavortium, is found throughout the southwestern dry areas of the southwestern United States. And they're out there with the spadefoots. And they are, the ground, things dry up, the ground cracks, and they follow those fissures down and get down into near moist soil and keep their body moist and essentially estivate until it rains again. We'll talk about estivation later on. Okay, so they're a pretty cool salamander found in our continent. Any questions? All right, the Protidae, the mud puppies, and the water dogs are also found. They're six species, so only accounting for 1% of the species in the order. They are found in the United States, the eastern United States, and in Europe. These are obligate paedomorphic. Okay, obligate paedomorphic. So they are always aquatic. In other words, the larvae, the adults, well, the larvae transform into, develop into adults, and they do not go through metamorphosis. They do not become terrestrial. They're always aquatic. All right. So these organisms are restricted to permanently flooded areas for the most part. Well, they are. They have a depressed body and external gills, and as you can see in this picture, Nectaris, this is very similar to probably Paleozoic amphibians. That type, and I'll show you some pictures later on of early amphibians having that depressed head, etc. Again, more of a flat type body for less resistance. They have reduced limbs and a powerful tail for swimming. Some diet studies have been done with Nectaris and indicate that they prefer crawfish, although they'll pretty much eat anything that they can come across in the water. The sixth family is the sirens. There are four species. They are found just in the southern United States. They also are obligate paedomorphic, and they really have degenerate limbs, okay? More so than the mud. We do not know very much about their biology, although we think this is a case with the salamanders that there is external fertilization. Very little is known about the sirens and their reproductive strategies. They do have, unlike all other salamanders that have teeth in the front of their mouth. They have a premaxillary beak, which is thought to assist in crushing prey items. Oops, sorry. Okay. Good. All right. Here are the torrent salamanders I was talking about before. Again, similar with respect to habitats to the plethodontids, which these are found in the northwestern United States, coastal Pacific Northwest. So they run up into British Columbia as well. These are semi-aquatic. And as I mentioned before, they don't have an operculum, so they really can't hear. And again, in a very fast-moving stream, there isn't a whole lot to hear anyways, all right, except water rushing around. And this family, they do have lungs, but they have reduced lungs. And I'll check into if this is the family that, if it's just one lung reduced or if both are reduced. You have reduced lungs. And they have a bright yellow abdomen. All the torrent salamanders do. Kind of a key diagnostic characteristic. All right. The eighth family, the giant salamanders. Dicamptodontidae. There are four species. Again, all of these are found in the northwestern United States and up into Canada. And as their name implies, these are the largest salamanders. No, they are not the largest salamanders, excuse me, but they are large. Let's see. Largest living terrestrial salamanders. Because the hellbenders are certainly, which we haven't gotten to, a lot bigger than these guys. So these are salamanders. These are the largest living terrestrial salamanders. They're around 10 inches long in the terrestrial form. And they have Vomeran teeth. So they really are very efficient predators. They will eat small rodents, as you can see in this picture. As well as insects and anything else that comes around, other small amphibians, etc. Yeah. Vomeran. Oh, I'm sorry. That's what the M is there for. They are actually in an M shape, which helps in grabbing and ripping and capturing prey. Yeah. These guys do develop. It takes a couple years or even up to 5 years to for the larvae to develop and metamorphose into adults. Most of your salamanders, a year to 2 years. So these are long developing salamanders. Okay. The next group, the next family, is Amphiomidae. I've always had trouble saying that. Amphiomidae, okay. Three species, all which are found within the southeastern United States. The picture that you see there is the species that we have in Tennessee, the three-toed. These are obligate pedomorphs, and without a question, they certainly have an eel-like appearance. And of all the aquatic, obligate pedomorphic aquatic salamanders, the limbs in this family are the most reduced. They're very, very small and pretty much ineffective. The interesting thing is that the larvae have gills, okay, external gills, but they lose those gills and actually retain a gill slit. But they don't have gills. They don't have internal gills. They don't have external gills as adults, but they retain that gill slit, which is kind of interesting. They do have lungs. Okay. And they also have an interesting courtship and mating where they actually, the male actually directly deposits the spermatophore into the spermatheca of the female, whereas usually that spermatophore is laid someplace, placed someplace, and the female picks it up with the cloacal lips. So that is unique for this family. Okay, the last family, the hellbenders. There are three species. These are in the eastern United States and China. They're obligate pedomorphic and similar to the Amphiomidae is that they have no gills, no external gills as adults. Well, again, the larvae have external gills. The adults have no external gills or internal gills, but they have that gill slit. And again, they have lungs. If you've ever seen a hellbender, these things are pretty prehistoric looking organisms. And it looks like they may have just lost about 100 pounds or so. They are really have a lot of excessive skin, okay? And it looks like their skin is just kind of flapping around. And it's believed that that helps in respiration. And this is a group that does have external fertilization. They're also considered the most primitive of the salamander groups. Okay, so we have the beaked Sicilians being the most primitive within the Sicilians. The hellbenders are considered the most primitive within Caudata, and they also are the largest salamanders in the world. That is a good question, but in general, you'd be lucky if 1% of any amphibian, 1% of the eggs laid for any amphibian actually makes it to adulthood, is recruited into the next population.
Should we be learning by family
commenting? By both. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions?
How big is the largest?
These guys can get to, hellbenders can be about 2 feet long. So I think the largest is, let's see real quick here if I have the size. Yeah, 1.5 meters, which is actually really big. it's bigger than a couple feet. I've never seen any. Actually, I've never seen a hellbender never held one in my hand. I've seen them in zoos.
Do they occur in fast-moving streams?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do.
And they still have external fertilization.
Well, that's a good point. When they go through courtship, fast-moving streams, but they find areas that are pools, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In Smokies, don't they look for them underneath big rocks?
Right, yeah. They get into areas where that current slows down, and they also are found in slower-moving streams, but they inhabit both.
Do you recall what school it was that was down in the Smokies?
Oh,
is that
I'm not quite sure. It might be Middle Tennessee State. they've been doing some research on hellbenders. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure who's doing that work. Okay. So that wraps up our salamanders, y'all. 10 families. Okay, let's go through the characteristics of the anurans. What time is it?
6:30.
That is interesting. Somehow, my watch, it says 7:30 right now. And I thought I just stepped into some time warp. I was like, oh my God, how did I just go through? Okay, good. So 6:30. So let's go through the characteristics here of anura, because I actually want to show you a video, and then we'll stop there. We'll take a break, then we'll go through the families, okay? So anura. The characteristics of anura is that they have actually very few vertebrae, okay? So they have shortened sacral vertebrae. There are usually only eight, sometimes one or two more, one or two less, but usually eight. And the ribs are reduced or absent. If they are reduced, they're generally only on the second or the fourth vertebrae. The vertebrae are also firmly articulated. Okay, they're fused together. And they have large hind limbs and no tail, and except for one family I have there, although it's technically not a tail. Those are called the tailed frogs. Okay? It's actually an extension of the cloaca. Now, y'all with bright minds, thinking about just body structure, what do those things probably help you do? Reduce your ribs, okay? Shorten your the number of vertebrae. Make sure that it's relatively stiff. Have really strong legs, and no tail.
Jump.
Right. All designed to jump. Okay, and some can jump a lot farther than others. Okay, so salutatorial type locomotion is what those characteristics all allow anurans to do. Most frogs and toads can jump anywhere between 2 to 10 times their body length. It actually has been recorded for some species that they can jump 30 times their body length. So they are excellent as an order. They are excellent jumpers, as you all probably have observed at some time. Okay, video. Actually, let me do the remaining characteristics, and then we'll take a look at one of the videos here, which talks about basically the kind of the structure of and the evolution of the anuran skeleton. And it's only about two or three minutes, but it's a pretty neat summary. So they usually have external fertilization, almost always. They have flat heads and large mouths. Okay? So they're really literally a jumping mouth. Okay? And usually the males have a vocal sac and they call to attract their mates. So obviously hearing is an important thing with the anurans. And they do have tympanum and a middle ear. Okay. All right, let's see. Yeah, there's the distribution. They have a global distribution. There's 29 families. Without a question, they are the most successful currently. Currently, they are the most successful amphibian group, at least in the last 200 million years. We're doing our darnest, though, to change that. Okay, so let's go ahead and we will pause there, and I am going to hopefully show you a video on that. And then we'll take a break, and as I promised last time, I'll show during the short break that we have, I'll show some video clips of various endurance calling. And it's kind of neat, again, to see that. Yes, yes it is. I don't know if you've looked at some of those videos, but they're pretty cool. Yeah, yeah. All right, let me just pause the audio recording here. All right, so. All right, so we're talking about the Anurans and went through their characteristics, at least some of their characteristics, and mentioned they have a global distribution. There are 29 families, which we will kind of motor through. The first are the southern frogs, Leptodactylidae. They are the most speciose. There are around 1,200, 1,300 species in this family. 24% of the species within the order are leptodactylids. And this N right here in the top right corner stands for Neobatrachia, which is the suborder, remember? Remember, there are three suborders, Archaeobatrachia, Mesobatrachia, and Neobatrachia. These are considered the modern frogs. So all of the families that we go through, that this is the only one that has an N next to it. So all of them are Neobatrachia. The ones that are Mesobatrachia or Archaeobatrachia, which are the more primitive frogs, will actually have an M or for a Mesobatrachia or an A for Archaeobatrachia. Okay? So that's that notation. These are found in the Neotropics and the Subtropics. A characteristic that of this family is that for most of the species, the males defend and brood the eggs. They keep them moist, often providing secretions that, basically keep them moist. Some of the secretions do have an antibacterial, antifungal properties. This particular species, Eurythrodactylus cokei, is the frog of Puerto Rico. If you've ever been to Puerto Rico, it's kind of funny. You often read the tour guides and they'll say, welcome to Puerto Rico. If you listen very closely, you'll hear the elusive cokei. These things are like crickets, man, they're everywhere. And they have been introduced very interestingly into Hawaii and they're considered a nuisance. They're trying to get rid of these things. They're taking over some of the islands there. Now, Eurythrodactylus jasperi is also in Puerto Rico. It is the only species that is viviparous. All the others are direct development, and to the best of our knowledge, this species is extinct. It has not been seen in Puerto Rico for many years. Okay. Is that good? The next family are the tree frogs, Hylidae. And there are 835 species, or around 15% of the families in the order fall into this, 15% of the species in the Anurans fall into this family. They really have global distribution, and they are very well recognized. All tree frogs have large discs, suction-like discs on their toes to help them to climb. Some of them are very good jumpers, most of them are very good jumpers, but some also are not very good, and an example of that is the barking tree frog that we have in our state. Very good climbers, and in general, very good jumpers as well. A lot of these will breed in the tree, and, well, there are a lot of different strategies, actually. Lots will breed in the tree and lay their eggs, and bromeliads, etc., and then some actually lay over water, and anyways, there's a lot of different strategies. Most of them do have free swimming tadpoles, so their eggs hatch into larvae, and through one way or another they get to the water if they're not deposited directly. Okay, and they have tadpoles that develop. Okay. Next family, Ranidaes, the true frogs. Around 800 species in this family, around 15% of all of the total species. They have global distribution, and actually Africa and Asia have the most number of species. They have, as you have seen, the ranches around our state, they have very well-developed legs and webbed feet. They are generally associated with permanently flooded wetlands, and they're generally very good swimmers and can jump a long ways as well. Usually when they swim, their back legs propel at the same time. Okay? There is a family that is similar to the ranids where that is not the case. They actually alternate their back legs, which is considered more primitive, the alternating, propelling action. And most of these also have free-swimming tadpoles. The Bufonidae, the true toads, are the toads that you've seen and you're familiar with. They have around 500 species, 9% of the total species, have global distribution, and most of the species are in the genus Bufo. They are covered with numerous glands both mucus glands as well as your glandular glands for they have very thick skin. They generally can be found in very dry conditions and withstand very dry conditions. Their teeth are nearly absent. Okay, their pedicellate teeth are nearly absent. And they also, this order has what's called the biter's organ, which is a rudimentary ovary that's on the, well, I can't remember. It's on the testes. I can't remember if it's the anterior or posterior end. But it's a rudimentary ovary on the testes. And, it has no function as far as we know. All right, family number 5, the narrow-mouthed frogs, also called the narrow-mouthed toads. Around 450 species, or 8%. These are mostly tropical or subtropical. We certainly have some species, though, here in the United States, but they are restricted to the southern United States. They have 2 to 3 palatal folds. And most of them have that fold of skin between the eyes, as I've mentioned before, which, you know, is hypothesized to keep ants away from their eyes, which they often specialize in eating. This genus, Breviceps, is really interesting. When you look at narrow-mouthed toads, you know, obviously the thing that comes out is that it has a triangular-shaped head, kind of a narrow mouth, just as the name implies. but they're very rotund, right? Well, this particular genus is extremely rotund. In fact, they're so rotund, they cannot implex, the males can't implex the females. So that's not a very successful strategy, right? So they actually secrete, the males will excrete a secretion that is like a glue-type substance that literally temporarily glues themselves. They glue themselves to the back of the female until she releases her eggs. The next family, Rhachophoridae, the Asian tree frogs. There are around 280, 90 species, around 5% of the species. As their name implies, they're found in mostly in Asia, but also in Africa and India, mostly in Southeast Asia. They are also, this family is the family that Dr. Echternaut was talking about, that where they create that foam nest, that hanging foam nest where they deposit the eggs, and then the eggs, the tadpoles develop within it, and then actually fall through or eat through once they're through development and fall out, generally over water. Or the foam nest itself, again, often it's believed that with a lot of the species that it has some type of antimicrobial type properties. This particular species that we're looking at is in a group called the flying frogs, and that is because, although it's a little bit hard to see, they have between their digits, their fingers, they have extensive webbing, and they have very large hands, 4 feet. And their back feet are also webbed, and they can glide. They can jump, and they can actually glide through the forest. So like the flying squirrels that we have, they're not true flyers, but they can glide. Oops, I guess that was it. All right. Questions? All right, the African tree frogs. So we have around 260 species of African tree frogs. They are found in Africa, Madagascar, and Seychelles. They have a vertical pupil, very similar to the Pelobatids, the Pelobatidae, the spadefoots. There are actually a couple families that do have that vertical pupil. In the United States, the only one is Pelobatidae, the spadefoots. They also have, like the hylids, they have very well-developed toe disc. That assist them in climbing. And they're also called the reed and the sedge frogs because these are often not, they are found in forested wetlands, but they are often found in emergent wetlands, and you can see them clinging to reeds and sedges, emergent wetland herbaceous, emergent herbaceous wetland vegetation. All right, the poison arrow frogs, Dendrobatidae. Around 5% of the species in this in the order are Dendrobatids. These guys are found in Central and South America, and they are very small. You often see pictures of these guys that it makes them look like they're this big, right? But these are small. They're very small, an inch in size for most of them. They're very brightly colored. And again, that's because they're warning their predators. They have very toxic skin. And the natives in Latin America, South America, used to catch these frogs and get the poison from the skin and put it on arrows and darts and actually use that to take down small mammals. So highly toxic skin. They, again, as I mentioned, are very small. And the males for this family call to the females, just like most of the Anurans. And they have various elaborate types of postures that they will give to males that come into their territory to basically say, get out of my territory. If an intruding male does not leave, then the males often wrestle. And the dominant male will end up taking over or retaining its territory or taking it over. This is also one of the families where the tadpoles will attach to the back of the males. Okay? So you'll have some type of direct development. The tadpoles will hatch or the eggs will hatch and the tadpoles will climb onto the back of the male and the male will take them to the water. That's a good question, actually. They're in the tropics and in a human environment. I want to say a couple weeks that they can actually be on the back of that male, but I'll look that up. That's right, the glandular glands. Mm-hmm. So they have glands very similar to our toads, except the poison is much more toxic.
Are there different poisons with different species?
That's a good question. I'll look into that. And actually, when we get to post-metamorphic survival, I'll be able to provide details on that. Okay, the Mantellidae. These guys are found around 165 species. These guys are found only in Madagascar. And when you look at them, obviously they look very similar to the dendrobatids. And yes, they have toxic skin. They're brightly colored, aposematic coloration, that warning color. And they're very small. And it is believed that basically these two families have evolutionarily converged. Their ranges do not overlap. All right, this is a very cool family, the glass frogs, Centralinidae. Around 140 species here, and these guys are found in Central and South America. And as their name implies, these are very transparent frogs. For many of the species, you can see their organs, and this family, as well as a couple others, do not have any ribs at all. Okay? And they're very small organisms. generally, the eggs are laid over a stream, and the males guard them until they hatch, and the larvae fall into a stream and develop within the stream. The glass frogs in Central and South America. Sorry about that. Okay. All right. The cryptic frogs. These are in the suborder Mesobatrachia. And as their name sort of implies, they have, their morphology is such that all of them look very similar to leaves. They also, it being in the more primitive suborder, they are not very good hoppers. They actually prefer to walk, as you can see this one doing. These guys are found in Asia and Indonesia. And as I mentioned, they all have a very leaf-like appearance. And they are poor jumpers. They prefer to walk around, which is very uncharacteristic of anurans. And one thing that is unique about them is they have a paddle-shaped tongue. And we will talk about the tongue mechanisms, etc., and different ways to capture in another lecture. We'll talk about some of the other species that have very unique tongues as well later on. And their tadpoles are surface feeders, and actually the oral disc of their tadpoles is up instead of down. Okay? And to facilitate acquiring food items. The water frogs, Myobatrachidae, around 130 species. These are found in New Guinea, Australia, and Tasmania. And the females actually will create a foam nest in the water. And this could be just a small puddle, or it could be in a larger body of water. And the males are attracted to that and deposit their sperm. This family does contain a Rheobatrachus, and Rheobatrachus, as you might remember Dr. Echternot talking about, is the genus that is extinct now. These are the gastric brooding frogs, okay, the ones that where the females swallow the eggs, the fertilized eggs, their gastric system shuts off, and the larvae develop within the gastric system, the intestinal system, the stomach of the female, and then metamorphose and emerge. And they are now extinct. Okay.
Do they make those in the presence of the male, or do they just leave them and let the male come to you?
In the presence of the male.
Okay. So mm-hmm. Just
yeah.
Male.
Yeah. Well, that may not be the case, actually. That's the male's responsibility to try to defend after he's fertilized them. But, so, she lays them in front of a male that she determines is worthy to breed with, and then the male deposits his sperm. And then, at that point, then the male attempts to guard those eggs till they develop. The squeakers, around 50 species, so we're really now at this point getting into relatively rare families, and we're not even halfway through, right? The squeakers, these are in the sub-Saharan region of Africa. And they were previously in Ranidae. Most of these guys lay their eggs in water and have free swimming tadpoles, and I really don't know a whole lot about them outside of that. Pipidae, the tongueless frogs, these are in Mesobatrachia, and the most well-known genera is Xenopus. Xenopus laevis is what we're looking at here. Those are the African clawed frogs. and there are 30 species. This particular frog is used a lot in research for various types of immunology studies, development studies, etc. They're very easy to raise in captivity. And they are found, the family itself is found in Africa and in South America. The Xenopus is from Africa. These are fully aquatic frogs, okay? And they have webbed feet, very long fingers with keratinized tips on them. And their eyes, like many salamanders and other anurans that are other amphibians that are totally aquatic, they tend to have their eyes more dorsal. And they have no tongue. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I don't know what the purpose is. Yeah, some type of, for grabbing. It may be related to breeding or, I guess potentially to capturing prey. Usually, keratinized portions of the forefeet are generally used in breeding, for breeding, but I'm not sure for Xenopus. Mm-hmm. Nearly all of them. They actually have to capture it. Yeah, that's correct. There is another family where it's similar, but they're terrestrial, and they don't have a protrusible tongue that comes out. The tongue of most anurans is actually folded back, and when they open their mouth, it flips out. And it sticks on to their prey item, and then they bring it back in. And there are a few variations where there's no tongue, or the tongue actually, they have a tongue, but it doesn't fly out like that. We'll hit on those as we go through these. Okay. This family here actually used to be combined with number 13, the squeakers. In fact, it's often combined. They're in, again, the sub-Saharan region of Africa, and as I mentioned, they're usually combined with the squeakers. But folks that break them apart, the squeakers actually do have a vertical pupil, and these guys have a horizontal pupil, and they also have toe discs. Not as developed as tree frogs, but they do have toe discs. And this is a picture here of the hairy frog, which is pretty unique. It during breeding, the males end up getting bristles on their bodies, and it's not really sure the function of those bristles, whether it's for camouflage or protection, aids in cryptic coloration, or some folks have suggested that it helps facilitate respiration. But that's kind of a unique species, kind of the poster child for this family. That's only during breeding, that's correct. The disc-tongued frogs, Discoglossidae, this is a very primitive group, a primitive family. In fact, they're in Archaeobatrachidae. There aren't very many species. They're found in northern Africa and southwestern Europe. And this is one of the families. There are certainly cases outside this family, but this family is known for the males carrying the eggs on the back of their hind legs. And again, until they'll carry them to water, and once they hatch, then they're a free swimming tadpole. Excuse me. The females for this family do vocalize some, although the actual function of that vocalization isn't very well known. Most females do not vocalize in anura. They are kind of toad-like appearance and toad-like in life history. These guys do burrow underground. They're fossorial. They will even call from their burrows. They call females into their burrows. Pelobatidae, the spadefoots, and remember we were going through Tennessee anurin identification. I told you these were this family's broken out. So some folks break this out into Pelobatidae, only being the spadefoots that are over in Europe, and then Scaphiopopidae, which are the ones in the United States. This is the way it's been traditionally, is Pelobatidae, where they're all in the same family. We're looking at the caoutchouc spadefoot. All of these guys are generally can withstand very dry conditions, and the caoutchouc spadefoot is certainly probably one of the best at withstanding dry conditions. It will actually excrete and encapsulate itself in a cocoon of excreted skin cells and mucus to keep itself moist during extremely dry conditions while it's estivating. And we'll talk about some of those adaptations later on. These are Mesobatrachia, again, a more primitive family. And there are 11 species worldwide, accounting for very little of the species makeup of this order. United States, Mexico, Europe, and Eastern Asia, where these guys are found. And I think I mentioned before that we have four species in our country. I know we have four. I can't think of any more. The eastern New Mexico plains and the caoutchoucs. These guys, as I mentioned, are found in xeric environments. They breed during the summer, and their breeding is stimulated by intense thunderstorms. They all come out and breed very quickly, within 3 days, and their larvae can develop as quickly as 10 days. Although, if you have a more permanent water source, their larvae will develop over a month. Again, they have a very fast developing larvae, and they do have carnivorous cannibalistic phenotypes, and we will talk about those later on. Actually, some of the salamanders do too. It's generally in areas that have very ephemeral habitats, very ephemeral water sources, where you'll get cannibalistic phenotypes. The pumpkin toads, Brachiocephalidae, the pumpkin toads. You can guess why they're called pumpkin toads, very brightly orange colored. 11 species, they're only found in southeastern Brazil, and they all have direct development. And most of them, not all of them, but most of them are bright orange. These are extremely small anurans. In fact, this family is considered the smallest tetrapod in the southern hemisphere. Three-eighths of an inch. Pretty darn small. Yes, they are toxic, yeah. All right, the next family, the fire-bellied toads and the barbarulas. These guys are in Archaeobatrachia, again, considered a very primitive family. There are 10 species, and these guys are found in the Eastern Hemisphere, Europe, Turkey, Russia, China, Korea. You will find them in pet stores here. And they, as mentioned before, with very brightly colored anurans, they have very toxic skin, and they have what's called an unkempt reflex, which is a predatory defense that when to startle a predator and to hopefully make that predator recognize, hey, I'm not something to eat. Their bellies are, for the fire belly toads, are very bright red. And when they're approached by a predator, they will actually rear back and arch their back and show their red belly to startle that predator and stop that predator. Unkempt reflex. Well, I certainly wouldn't, you know, lick the glands. It'd probably make you ill, you know, a little bit ill. And for children, licking a fire belly toad probably wouldn't be a good idea. Yeah. You also find, you'll find dendrobatids in pet stores too, which are even the toxin is more toxic. It's more concentrated than these guys. So. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it bad just to touch, or does it have to get like in the
bloodstream? Well, yeah, you have to ingest it, but that can, or you can get it in your eyes, etc. You know, for an adult, these things are not that big of a deal. For young children, it could be irritating, and depending on how they respond, they could have action, etc. The barbarulas are, now the fire belly toads are found generally in aquatic, more permanent aquatic type habitats, and the barbarulas are found in rocky streams. So a little bit uncharacteristic generally of what you would consider a toad, which most toads are found more in a mesophytic or xeric environment. The shovel-nosed toads are named for their kind of pointed beak, very much like the narrow-mouthed toads, shovel-nosed frogs, that is. Shovel-nosed frogs. One interesting thing about them is, hence their name, they dig with their nose, and they actually burrow, and they go in head first. That is very characteristic and uncharacteristic for any anurans. The spadefoots, your bufos, they all dig with their back feet and they go in backwards. These guys go in forward. There are only 9 species. They're in the sub-Saharan region of Africa. And as I mentioned, they burrow head first. They, in their burrows, again, they will, they'll lay eggs in their burrows. And they have an interesting tongue as well. They have a prehensile tongue that kind of comes out and grabs things. And it's believed because these guys are also specialized in eating ants, and when they're mostly under the ground, they can use that tongue to grab things. So that's a unique adaptation of them. The ghost frogs are found in Africa. There are 6 species, very southern Africa. These are all found in very fast-flowing streams in southern Africa. They have very well-developed toe discs, and the males have spines to help them secure themselves to the females during amplexus because of the fast-moving water. Their tadpoles also have oral discs that have very strong suctioning capabilities, and they can hold on to rocks in fast-moving streams. The name ghost frog, nobody really knows where that came from. It doesn't have to do with their appearance. But the first ones were collected in Skeleton Gorge in Cape Town. So that's where it's thought that the name a common name, ghost frogs, came from, being collected in Skeleton Gorge. All right. The Seychelles frogs, there are 29 species, all found in Madagascar. And an interesting thing, as far as the anurans, which most of them are in Neobatrachia, this is the only one in Neobatrachia that does inguinal amplexus. And that is when they grab around the waist. Now, we're going to talk about the different types of amplexus in the next lecture, or when we get to that, the courtship breeding lecture. But that inguinal amplexus, this is the only family where in Neobatrachia that does it. That's generally considered a primitive type of amplexus. These guys are very secretive, they're very small, and they're hard to find. They generally hide under litter and rocks within their habitat. They have direct development, and again, similar to dendrobatids, the tadpoles ride on the backs of the males. Except these are much more cryptic guys, and they do not have very toxic skin. When they're not there? I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's Seychelles is the French pronunciation or whatever, Seychelles or however you pronounce it. We're certainly part of Madagascar at one time.
Well, yeah. Well,
were they? Oh, yeah. Back. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we go through the evolution, we'll look at Pangaea and it breaking up and all that type of stuff. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, I have no idea. All right, getting towards the end, y'all. Let's at least get through the anurans. I don't even know where we're on time, but I'm probably pushing my time. Yeah, I am. All right, let's see these guys here. These are in Archaeobatrachidae as well. Let's see, four species found only in New Zealand. And these are the ones, Aaron, that don't have the protrusible tongue, all right? So they have to actively capture an organism, except these guys are on land, and the tongueless frogs are all aquatic. So they're more like a fish. Okay? These also do not call. So they have to rely completely on pheromones and direct encounters. They are relatively aquatic, and this is the family where I mentioned that when they are in the water, they do alternate kicking with their back feet. Again, that's considered more primitive, and you expend less energy per unit of distance that you travel than if you actually push your leg at the same time. All right, that's spelled incorrect. Parsley, not parlay, or parley. The parsley frogs, Pelodytidae. These are in Mesobatrachia, and they get their name from parsley look that they have on their back. These are found in emergent wetlands, and that certainly is a cryptic type coloration. These have a very limited distribution, a small region in southern Europe and a very small region between the Black and Caspian Seas, like in the Georgia area. they have very noticeable, and you can see that very noticeable bulging eyes, and they have that parsley, or it's spelled correctly, parsley colored cryptic coloration on the back, blended with emergent wetlands. And this is another family where the females are reported in vocalizing, but just when they're amplex, but not a whole lot is known. All right. This is the most primitive of family for the frogs right here, the tailed frogs. And these are, of course, in Archaeobatrachia, the primitive frog suborder, and the tailed frogs. Only two species of tailed frogs, and they are found in the northwestern United States and up into British Columbia. These guys inhabit very fast-flowing streams. And they have internal, this is the only family that has internal fertilization in Anura. And they use this tail-like structure, which is actually a cloacal extension. I may have actually had a true tail before in the old notes. That's not correct. I checked into that. There are no caudal bones in it. Okay? So it's a cloacal extension, and they use that basically for internal fertilization. Again, fast-moving stream. You don't want to let your sperm go flying out in a fast-moving stream, but it is not... It is not a true penis. The sperm runs down it and goes into the cloaca. And we'll talk a little bit about that when we do get to different types of breeding behaviors. again, as I mentioned, this is the most primitive extant family of anurans. They do not call, and it takes a long time, 7 years, around 7 years for the tadpoles to, well, for individuals to mature, become reproductively viable. All right, the mouth brooding frogs, Rhinodermatidae, there are two species. These guys are in Chile, only in Chile, southern South America. These are the ones that you may remember Dr. Echternot talking about that develop actually in the vocal sacs of the males, the tadpoles do. And their family name is translated into rhinoceros-nosed, and they have that very pointed proboscis-type nose formation. Okay? Oops. All right, last slide coming up here. Whew. All right, this species was just recently found, Rufin's frog, only one species in northeastern South America. We're not really sure if they're related to the glass frogs, and very little is known about their ecology. The next group here, the purple frog, was just discovered in 2003 over in India, I believe. Yeah, India. And they were discovered when they were digging, some folks were digging a well, and they found these prehistoric creatures, or what looked like prehistoric creatures. I actually took them to a botanist in the region. He's like, I've never seen them, who then got a hold of colleagues that... figured out this is a new species that we, and the reason why they haven't been encountered is that they're extremely fossorial. Again, that looks like a fossorial type animal. Look at the nice stout legs, has a very pointed nose here, and they are like many fossorial organisms like the spadefoots and some of the toads. They only come out for a short period of time and breed explosively. And so that's why they're not seen very often. And so we know very little about these guys at this point. The last one, number 29, the Mexican burrowing toad in Mesobatrachia. Again, relatively primitive species. They're found basically from Costa Rica to the Rio Grande, and these are also a fossorial species. They're relatively common, though. They are explosive breeders, and they are ant-eating specialists. In fact, they have an ant-eater-type tongue. They don't open their mouth. It actually comes through, and it comes out and grabs ants. And they have no teeth. All right, y'all, that is an overview of the class Amphibia. And so now you know how diverse, at least you have a feeling for how diverse and interesting and widespread these creatures are. And so what we'll do is next time is get into basically the origin of amphibians and the fossil record of amphibians. And that will not take the whole time. So we will also get into the next lecture, which is based on courtship and breeding. Okay? So, sorry if I kept you a little bit long today, but thanks for your patience. Any questions, by the way?